Today will be another question and answer. Oh, I forgot my little packet of questions, which I can go get if there is any shortage of questions from the cloud or the dirt. But last Sunday, what did we get? We got through two questions. So, yeah. If you And that no question is stupid or too profound. Alan?
My question is about relationship. Like, let's say if you like somebody and you want to get married, but would that be an attachment if you're married to somebody? Right? Like you should feel when you're in love and you're together, but when you're not in love, you should go somewhere else.
Yeah, like human relationships. I mean,
Right.
that's which is interesting because we have this in Buddhism, we hear like attachment is bad,
Right,
right?
that
And then
cause suffering, right?
but then attachment is a word in English that we mean like we means we care about somebody, like we like somebody. We it's gonna have a positive thing. So yeah, that's a good question. Maybe the simplest thing that springs into my mind is the attachment that we're looking to let go of in practice is self-attachment. So you can imagine, like, okay, so let's say you have a involved, affectionate, committed, whatever, whatever, a relationship with someone. And we might say in a positive way, we are attached to them. And in what way could we be like kind of negatively attached to them, right? Where is the self-attachment? So if I need you to act in a particular way because it will make me feel a, particular way or make me feel secure or so I need to kind of manipulate you for my own purposes. Or, an example from my own life, which fortunately is not so relevant anymore, but I used to suffer from just really irrational jealousy, just like imagining all the ways that this person with whom I have become very, but to whom I have become very attached could like betray me and leave, and I could be hurt, I could be disappointed, and it was kind of a paranoia kind of thing. And then, the response to that is often to kind of like cling to the person and make them reassure you, and that only makes them more like kind of freaked out, and it might drive them to actually, do some of the things that you fear because you don't trust them, right? So it's that's some where like self-attachment can get worked into these relationships. So in a way, then you've got to say, what would be like a very warm, engaged, loving relationship that wasn't attached? What would that look like? And in some ways, I don't know, maybe we should steer away from the word attached because I like to think of like our sense of self is generally deluded. Like we have a sense, I am here, you are there, we have this relationship, but our sense, our self is truly something that's much more interdependent with all things. So in a sense, if I'm in a close relationship with somebody, where's the boundary between self and other, right? You are part of me. My husband is part of me. My pets are part of me. My sangha is part of me, right? So that is why when we lose someone, when it hurts, right? This is like it's like having a part of us cut off. So in that sense, I like to think of this more when we allow ourselves to become interdependent with other people, and we're opening ourselves up to this way in which like they kind of become part of us. Then what would be a kind of ideal way to navigate that interdependence and closeness? And I don't know, there's probably lots of ways that we could describe that, but I know that for me, it involves like a respect for the others, like autonomy and Buddha nature. There's ways that we feel like those with whom we've gotten really involved, they owe us something. And I don't think that's very helpful thinking. Even though people are just like, what do you mean? Like, if I'm married to somebody and they're going out and doing this thing, that's like, that affects me. And therefore I have a right to say, and I guess in a certain sense, that may be the case if you have a set of vows and you can hold somebody to their vows. But really, like, the most effective relationship is one of mutual respect and saying, you know, when you do that thing, it hurts me. I hope you don't go spend all our money, right? Like that kind of that kind of thing. But you can't, but that the effort to control or the fear, right? That's where the kind of the self-attachment comes in, where for me, I notice when the wording in my mind becomes like this, this has to stop, or this has to start, this has to be this way, that now I'm starting to get like self-involved in it, where it's frankly scary to be intimate with people. It's scary to be interdependent with them. If you are intimate with beings, then they can hurt you. That's just the way it is. So like that kind of courage in the face of that, not having to react with fear or the effort to control or manipulate, I think is a real, you know, ideal to be practiced toward. Yeah, other thoughts on that? Definitely not an exhaustive treatment of the subject, but any other thoughts on kind of loving relationships?
Forgot about this one. It's actually a question on a question, and I don't know if I'm recalling it from a podcast that you already did, but didn't you mention someone who said that you should treat the people that you love like trash? Is that from the podcast? Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you remember who I'm talking about?
Yes. Yeah. So, right, there are some things in Buddhist, there are some Buddhist scriptures, teachings, whatever, that suggest that the ideal is to just have no more attachment to your loved ones or whatever than you would to trash. Which is, you got to ask, what is that getting at? Right? Like my Dharma grandmother, Roshi Kennett, would say, you're right to doubt what you think it means, right? It's like, well, that can't be telling us to like treat people like we treat garbage, right? Like, and yet, I guess when you think about on the other side of our ideal, like the Zen ideal is, well, how do you treat garbage?
Yeah.
Do you hate garbage? Do you throw garbage out and then like stomp on it? You know, like you're just garbage means it's something that isn't supposed to be around anymore. It doesn't have a use anymore. So maybe what's that pointing toward is like when we find that circumstances mean that this loved one, this relationship, whatever is moving away from us, that we don't do this to it, right? That we like let it go.
That things serve a purpose and eventually we have to let everything go.
Yeah, exactly. Katie.
Well, I just wanted to add something.
Yeah.
Because I've been in a marriage for over 40 years, and we've done we've had some counseling. And one of the things that we've been told to do, and it's really hard, is always assume the other person comes into the relationship with goodwill. You know, so you're like, now to me, I don't know if it has to do with attachment or non-attachment, but that is a Buddhist attitude.
Yeah,
I think that whole attachment, non-attachment thing, I think that's a, I don't know. I think that must have come from the tradition when people, the when Buddhists were mostly in monasteries or something, honestly, because I think that there's a lot of room in a relationship to practice Buddhism. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, I just kind of, whenever I hear that non-attachment thing, I just kind of go, yeah, I don't know. And, but then the other, the ways that you treat your partner, I mean, that's tough. It is tough to assume that they are treating you, that they have a legitimate reason for the weird stuff that they come up with. And they have the same trouble with you. I mean, admit it, everyone, everyone does that.
Yeah.
So anyway, this, so I just would, I think it's almost like that, that question always creates all this heat and light and, you know, everybody gets all into it. But the actual question, I think, is how do you treat your partner?
Yeah. Indeed. And the, and it's like the, really the closer someone is to us, the more challenging it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can like have meta toward guy over there that we hardly know, have nothing to do with, right? But when somebody's like, what they do, how they act, you know, affects your every single day, right? Like, it's very difficult to have that space. Another way that I've translated the term attachment, some of you may have heard this before, is do we take something, a person, a job, a skill, whatever, and do we attach it to ourselves? I think of it as like, I'm a vacuum cleaner, lots of attachments. And if I'm gonna take you, like you and I are friends, and now I've taken Katie and like I've attached you to me, and now this is my sense of myself, and I got to protect all of this, and it's part of me. And you can see where that would get complicated, not be ideal, right? Can we relate to something without it becoming something that we kind of attach to our self-identity? And therefore, in that small kind of defensive self, right, a sense of self. Well, follow-ups on that? Any other questions?
Jeez. A new question.
A new question. All right.
It might be related. I don't know. It probably does. I mean, it all relates. Is, you know. I was reading the instructions for the cook, the Uchiyama Roshi. Version, and there's a phrase in there that the translation of it said, and he's talking about if you get low quality ingredients from the storehouse manager, whatever, or you get really high quality ingredients from the storehouse manager to make the meal, you should treat them equally, whether they're really high quality or they're really low quality. And it, the phrase was something like, I wish I was like, I'm going to commit this to memory.
Yeah.
It's like to treat the object differently based on its perceived quality is counter to the Dharma. Right. And I was struck by that because it was like, well, okay, he's talking about like, you know, radishes, but he's not really just talking about radishes either. You know, he's talking about everything. And like, especially like in this current our current situation in America in particular, like we're there's so much judgment about this is quality, this is not quality, this is good, this is bad. And how are we showing up and relating to those things that we perceive as either being high quality or low quality? And how does that affect our practice? There's a question in there. I don't know what it is, but I just, if you had any thoughts around like how we approach our perceptions, our judgments of, you know, good or bad, and how we work with that in our practice.
Well, others may end up wanting to pipe up about that, but it's reminding me of something that I've been working on. I find that the way that I want, and y'all probably have found this as well, the way that works for me to describe Zazen or mindfulness or something, it changes over time. It's like, I'll have a description or kind of an approach and I'll be like, all right, like I've found it. And then I don't know, then, you know, a month later, I'm describing it some other way. It's like but right now, like, cause I've talked to you before about, like, I've struggled with mindfulness as an effort, as a sense of like, I am trying to discipline my unruly mind to pay attention to this thing. And, you know, it's been very, agitating and disappointing. But lately I've been doing more like enjoy each thing. Enjoy brushing your teeth, enjoy eating your cereal, enjoy driving, enjoy packing up your bag, enjoy greeting your dog when you get home, or enjoy all of that. And when you like, just that enjoyment for me just opens up a little bit in a positive way, not at all about like, don't be thinking about other things. Like, it's just, if you enjoy it, you naturally kind of let go of thinking about things that aren't there. And I mean, frankly, I'm kind of bored at the gym. I'm on the treadmill. And so kind of, but even that, to enjoy, like, enjoy moving your body, enjoy having a body to move, enjoy the health that you have to be able to do this. So that's helping. But then, like, my life is fairly enjoyable in general. So I'm kind of like, what about when it's not? And I'm going to go to session, and probably as early as tomorrow evening, there will be a substantial amount of time that will not be enjoyable because it will hurt, right? Like, I feel more physical pain over time, and, you know, it'll be some really annoying thing in the middle of my back. And just, I mean, and sometimes it's fine. Sometimes I can, you know, sometimes it's really not bad, but then sometimes it's like the whole evening, the whole time. It's just an endurance test to get through, just like, oh my God. So then. What is mindfulness? I was like, I don't want to be mindful now. I just want to anticipate this being over. But like that, can it be like unconditional enjoyment? Like, if you can't enjoy it because it's not very pleasant, then can we enjoy just being alive? Just being alive to even experience this unpleasant thing, right? Yeah, so I don't know. That's not directly related to what you're talking about, but that kind of becoming free of our own opinions and preferences in favor of the attitude that actually we want to live with.
Oh, Del Mio. Both of these questions are really great.
And you're unmuted. Do you have something?
Can you hear Ruthann? Can you hear me?
Hello.
Is the speaker on?
Oh,
you were on.
Oh, Domio.
Oh, speaker's not on.
Speaker's on.
Go ahead, Bob. Now he's muted.
Now you're muted.
Try again, Ruth Ann. You've been trying to get in for some time.
Okay.
Domio.
Yes.
Thank you for these questions. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. We had our speaker off in the Zendo. Okay. None of you would have been able to see anything.
I thought it was my, wonky phone. So both questions are good. And early on, one of the words in our Soto Zen precept is the word ease. So I go into don't know mine, be open. And when that, for me, foot pain starts when I'm sitting and I think, okay, there's the phrase, it's temporary, it won't last forever. Or maybe, oh, today it's my feet, not my head pain. So, but that concept of ease, I'm open, reminds me of Rumi's poem about welcome the house guest. Even if it's someone who takes all your furniture, there may be a delight beyond that you can't anticipate. So, I mean, that might sound naive, but attachment is sometimes putting our expectation on what we hoped or wished. And I hear from my friends with adult children when maybe they do something that they don't agree with, they have to say, okay, I don't own their lives. I still love them and we communicate and that's what matters. So not being attached allows us to wider goals, if you want, or open to whatever life might have for us individually.
Thank you. Travis.
Hi. I know that you've spoken to this in previous sessions, but with attachment with respect to what's going on in our country, what I would like to see happen in this country and what is actually happening in this country. Sorry, I'm kind of, my brain's a bit scattered here. There are many people in my family who support what's happening. And I'm very much attached to my opinions that they are not only wrong, but kind of reprehensible in a lot of ways. And that my attachment to that breeds anger, and that anger breeds contempt. And it's led to a whole host of challenging conversations. I just had one yesterday. And I don't like who I am when I behave from a place of anger. But I also, I guess I find the hardest part of it to be that on the merits, for whatever it's worth, I think I'm right, right? Like I don't know, I guess I'm just curious if you can speak to whether there is a place for any of that kind of attachment to a kind of moral certitude, maybe. I don't know. I've been struggling a lot with it lately. And I, like I said, I had a difficult conversation with a family member yesterday where I know I was antagonistic and contemptuous. And I feel, like I just said, that on the merits, that rightfully so. But I know it's not in accordance with anything we talk about in here. And it's not in accordance with anything I read on Zen Buddhism. And it makes me feel like there's something corrosive, you know, on my soul. So I'm just curious.
The struggle. the beautiful thing about our practice is that it gradually helps us be in touch with, I don't know, for lack of a better word, our center. To be more authentic, undefended. And that is a place where we can speak and act from. But when we speak and act from that place, which is, it is our offering to the world. It's not based on a conviction that we are right in some absolute sense. It's our response. Like, I'm standing here right now, and that looks like that needs to stop. And we, like, if you look at the stories of the Zen masters, you know, when they have it, they have a response. They're not wishy-washy. They're not retiring. They have a response. But that response is, it's not a fixed position. So if we think about being attached to our opinions, there's a way that we can become attached to a view, and then, right, then we stick it on ourselves, and then we kind of have to protect that. And when we meet somebody who disagrees, we are ourselves, our whole view of the world is threatened, and we have to say something. We have to try to convince them otherwise, even if that's unlikely to happen. Like, there's a compulsion to, like, I gotta respond. Where we could have a very, very deep conviction, like I do, about the way that we need to start living on this planet, the way that we need to relate to nature and to each other if we want to survive, right? But if I encounter someone who, I don't know, is acting or speaking in a way that's counter to that, I'm not reactive to this situation. I can look at the situation and think of is there any response, anything that I can do here that will help? And most of the time, no. Most of the time, when we're talking about people with competing viewpoints, it's really not even worth it. I mean, like, our viewpoint, they're just going to get more entrenched in their viewpoint. I mean, I totally get into this, right? It's like, if I hear my mom or somebody say something, I'm like, you don't understand. That's not really how it works. And I would just be like this, trying to, like, make my case. I'm like, what? It's not actually helping. It's not actually changing anything at all. So now I'm better able to kind of hold still and maintain contact with that, with my truth, but also maybe just be like, And we never know, like, just being quiet. They know you're on the other side, and maybe your stillness about it is actually going to make them curious. Or, you know, I mean, you never know how your responses might actually have an effect. Anything else you want to like say or ask or?
Well, I intellectually, I and spiritually, I find that to be completely true, and it's certainly been true in my experience. I guess what I what I'm struggling with just on a personal level is at this point the despair. At the where I know where I'm being ineffective here is that it's not even an attempt to change these people's minds. It's to make sure they feel how much I abhor their worldview. Mm-hmm. I feel that impotence, right? And so I'd be the first to admit that it's essentially impotent rage. And that's why I feel like it's undoubtedly corrosive to my own soul, let alone to whatever self-perception they may have or whatever. But I just, I don't know. It just feels so overwhelming in this regard. And it makes me bless the person I want to be, but I also, I don't know. It's just a struggle to channel this in any way that feels remotely decent or productive. And I know I'm failing at it, but.
It's when we want to be honest with someone in our life, it's very tricky, and it's not, Buddhism doesn't have a soul handle on this. There's many different descriptions of compassionate communication that talk about this, but if we can speak from our own experience and not have it be about that stuff out there or that their opinion or their actions or something. I mean I'm not giving advice, but just, you know, what would it be like if you said to your family members, it hurts me to talk about this, just to discuss this and hear your views fills me with despair. I mean, that's not a debate. That's just being honest. So maybe out of compassion for them, or out of their compassion to you, perhaps, they will give you some space. You reminded me. This was announced on the Sangha email list, and it will also be in this week's newsletter. I'm trying something experimental that I'm calling the Buddhist Mobilization Project. And we're going to have an exploratory Zoom meeting on March 27th when I get back from session. And the gist of it is that we all commit to 2 hours of action each week, an average of 2 hours of action, or 8 hours a month, or, you know, whatever. It doesn't have to all be every single week, right? But doing something. And then as a sub-sangha, if you will, we meet and we hold each other accountable to that commitment to doing something. And if we don't know what to do, then we help each other decide what to do, something to do. And then we take that action and we meet and support each other in that action and talk about how it relates to practice. But I have felt for myself in the past when I got active which I would say that I really haven't been for quite a long time. It did an immense amount for my mental health. It was so amazingly empowering because I was doing something and I was doing as much as I could. And therefore it was like this huge weight just lifted off my shoulders. It's kind of like, yeah, we may be going to hell in a handbasket, but I'm doing my part, right? So anyway, I just figured, you know, because you were mentioning that I would invite you all to check that out if it appeals at all. They have Ewan and then Richie, although Denny, you had your hand up before, but did you?
Oh, I put it down because it looks like we don't have much time, but I just wanted to let Travis know that is he still here? For some reason, I can't.
The screen.
I'm here. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. There's not much time, and I'm sorry. Ewan has his hand up too. Ewan, you need to. I just want you to know, Travis, that, oh my goodness, Domio knows this. I have been through the exact same situation you're in right now. And I guess I'll just say if you would like to talk about it, I know you probably have plenty of other people to check in with, but I just want to let you know, what I would have said now or in the Sangha, I'm happy to share with you offline. So that's all I need to share. I want to share.
Thank you so much. I truly appreciate that. And I would take you up on that. I can put my my email or my phone number in the chat.
Great. Or
and yeah. Heck, maybe any of you who are out there feeling,
yeah.
Are kind of lost and quite, you know, at sea, surrounded by differently thinking folks. I mean, some of us here have the opposite problem where we're kind of in a little liberal bubble and we're shocked when Trump won. So, and you know, and like when, no, I don't think anybody else would have been Trump shocked, but we were like, what do you mean? Everybody I know.
And mine are family members too, Travis. So that makes it even more difficult.
All right, Ewan.
You know, very, very similar to what Denny was saying is that I just kind of I identify so much with what you were saying, Travis, even though I'm in kind of the other side of the pond. Do you know, I with everything that's been happening, I just keep thinking about kind of friends and my Sangha, which are obviously much more in the US than here, and that impotent sort of just disgust that you feel at some of the things that you hear, and it's not always that you say something because you think you can convince them. It's because you feel like you're betraying your community if you don't, almost. And all of my background's in trauma, and I think it's something that so many people that are feeling like they're under attack at the moment, to a lesser extent here, I'm not going to make out what's happening here is the same, but there's a lot of people that are getting attacked. There's a lot of attacks on refugees and things here, is that it's okay to not feel like you need to take up every fight when you're experiencing fight or flight, because like you say, it's not always the person that you feel like you want to be. And it sounds like you're obviously very passionate about the stuff that you're talking about, and I think your community will benefit from having you for a long time, and you can only do that if you pace, which is something that isn't easy when you feel like the world's crumbling around you. And I just, if it brightens anyone's day, I'm from a part of Scotland called Ayrshire, and Trump has a golf course about kind of 30 miles down the road from me, and it was vandalized quite significantly the other day by some locals. And I wouldn't always advocate for vandalism, but I think given the circumstances, any kind of feeling of non-violent civil disobedience can give people a wee bit of satisfaction. And I just wanted to offer that, is that the people are, certainly everyone around me is feeling a lot of solidarity with you at the moment. So I just wanted to offer my love as much as anything else. Cheers, folks.
Koji? Then people can see you.
Yeah, I just wanted to let Travis know as well that I think everyone in this room is feeling like he is. And I think mobilization is a great idea. I come from the 60s and, you know, where we would just really take it up, you know, organize and community. And I don't know, as far as the personal, like family, fortunately for me, my family is very liberal, and, you know, I come from immigrants, Mexican immigrants, that, you know, I'm legal. I was born in Texas. My mom's birth certificate says Viejo Mexico, Old Mexico. So it's not even like, you know, I could be gone tomorrow. No, I'm just saying, we have to just kind of rise, because it's, you know, the moment is here, and whatever we can do, however we feel, is our personal way of doing our bit. I just say it's time, and thank you, Travis, for doing it in your way. That's about all I have to say. Thank you.
For those of us who have done activism in the past, I was really involved in climate activism back around 2000 or so, and this isn't a Buddhist teacher talking here, this is just me. There's part of me that is excited, because we have been on a collision course with disaster for quite a long time now. But, you know, our lives are pretty comfy. And they just kind of go along, and, you know, so there wasn't much appetite for activism. I mean, I sent out an email about this Buddhist mobilization project, and so far there are 25 people signed up who are interested. Not that they're committed, right? But they're just like, let's start talking about this. If I had done that 6 months ago, like, I would have probably five of the usual suspects who are already doing activism, right? Like, so there's some ways in which the extremity, the ridiculous, inconceivable extremity of what we are facing is a wake up call. I would rather we not, all that stuff be not happening. But on the other hand, if it gets us to take action and to stand up, and there's many, many different ways to take action, and that's one of the ways that we'll talk about in this group. And that's, you know, because people always think about being out in the street, you know, and for some people that's not really it. So a friend of mine told me about a really awesome, very different kind of action that we might be able to hook some people up with. And that is accompanying people to their ICE appointments, as being a friend that you get hooked up. And if somebody has going to an ICE appointment, an undocumented immigrant, or maybe a documented immigrant, you are, and you yourself have full citizenship and a relative privilege, that you just accompany them. So I mean, that's the, you know, there's so many different things that we could be doing. I think Livia had her hand up first.
Thank you, Domio, and thank you, Travis, for the question. I just wanted to add, so I'm living in a fairly conservative red state, and for me it's been quite the opposite, feeling like I'm the outsider, and most of my friends are on the opposite of the political spectrum. So for me, it wasn't really a shock that Trump won. I did cry on that day. I told my husband I'm in disbelief, but it wasn't necessarily shock. It was just being sad, basically. And just to give you like my perspective and what's helped me being here is, because I debated for a long time just leaving my group of friends, because they are so, they're not like-minded at all. And as I contemplated on the sense of isolation that I would feel, because I still live here in this state and I have no prospect of moving anytime soon, as I contemplated on that, the idea came to me that, similar to the way I forgive my kids for, you know, knocking over a glass of water, I would have to forgive my friends and my neighbors and the people who voted what they voted. Not because I am gaining anything of it, but because people need love all the time. And they need love, particularly in the situation where they make awful choices for themselves. And I love these people because I've known them for years. I've lived here for 10 years and I have to keep living with them. So, yeah, whatever the consequences of their choices might be, I have to forgive them and love them nonetheless. So that's what helped me where I am. I don't know if that makes a difference for anyone. And thank you, Domio, for adding some points of action where we can actually take action and do things, because that's sorely needed. And yes, it feels good to connect with like-minded people and to feel like you belong. Thank you.
Thank you, Livia. That's a beautiful way to frame it and think about it and to really make it part of our practice. And that brings in that concept of skillfulness, right? Which makes so much sense when we think of children. And I know it can sound a little bit like we're being condescending, right? We're saying like, oh, if somebody is opposite me on the political spectrum, they're like a child. That's not what we mean. But like, when we're dealing with a child, and like you said, they're making some bad choices, but hopefully, I mean, maybe we get angry or something, but we know that's not how we really want to respond, right? When we're able to respond skillfully, we think, all right, what's going to work here? What's actually going to work? Maybe I got to promise them we're going to get a trip to Burger King if you do something different, right? Or maybe, who knows? Maybe you got to tell them a spooky story. Maybe you got to be stern. Maybe you got to, you know, who knows? I mean, one of the greatest points of hope that I have is how really cool electric Ford, like, 250s are, right? Or the biggest Ford pickup trucks. Like, they're actually like amazing machines that if you are a You know, you go out, you can plug your equipment into them, you can run a generator off of what, like you can, it, and there's part of me that feels like that's like the kind of the goodie that will just, all of a sudden there'll be like all kinds of folks in red country, like driving electric vehicles. And I think it just might be a little, just a little way in. I don't know. Yeah, Denny.
I'm sorry, I'm here again. I was thinking that this ended at 2 or I would have shared. And I just want to say what Livia just shared. And I still would like to talk to Travis, but that came very, very close to what I wanted to say. And I wanted to thank her for it, because what I realized about the people that were just making me so miserable is that I was letting them do that to me, and they were the ones that were miserable. And I worked on it with a lot of Zazen and a lot of metta and things like that. But I eventually got to the point where I could just let it go and let them be who they were and do everything that I could to help the people I could help. And it's really helped me turn it around. So thank you, Livia, and everybody else that's contributed. And I'd still like to talk to you, Travis, only if you want to. But yeah, I think what Livia just said was spot on. I just wanted to tell her that.
All right. Thank you all. Dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Parami.